put your other stool over there. You can put your coffee on.
No, no, that's all right. Is this good?
Yep.
All right, maybe it should be further away. Oh, we're going to take it off. I forgot about it. Okay. Oh, good. Well, good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And we're really having a good time. I love it here. And I'm looking forward to sharing some more. One of the points I'd make for those of you that are new, if you go to Big Book Studies or if you're just reading the Big Book, take a look at how it's written. And you'll see that it was written to someone who got it by mail. They wrote in and they saw Saturday Evening Post or something like that, and they wanted to get sober, and so they mailed them the book. They took the steps themselves and got sober. And then they showed, and then they started AA in Wiggins, Mississippi, because in working with others, it says, now comes the best part. You're going to see an entire AA community spring up around you. It's going to be wonderful, but you're going to start it. And they went out and found people in jails and hospitals, and that's how AA got started in many, many places. In the other places, it got started because somebody got sober in Maryland and moved to Virginia, and then they were able to show. So, but the book is written that way. It's written to you as the reader. And I find that fascinating that they got sober without a step study. They got sober without a sponsor. They got sober. So just think back about the power of these ideas that are contained in those 12 spiritual principles. And think about the person who got it, who stuck to it, and found a minister or a friend or someone to take the fifth step with, and actually went out and did it. That's really fun to imagine that you got the book and you're all shaking and you're going to get sober by following these directions. So I find that just fascinating. And when you read it, you'll see it's talking to you. Now you can, and this is what we did. Let's see, what other overall thing? Oh, Bob made a very important point yesterday about these first three steps. And it is that they are constantly the reason that we're doing the rest of the steps. So when we get to step four, the reason we're doing step four is to get step three done. In other words, we're trying to surrender 100%, and we're trying to surrender my, you know, I had a problem with God, so my sponsor said, well, turn your life over to whatever will take it. And if you do that, you are no longer in charge. And as he put it, the management of my life was no longer in the hands of an idiot. So any random passerby would make better decisions than I was making, and we would take a step forward. So it's not that we have to have a full understanding of what this power is that we are turning our life over to. It's just that we're going to really do well if we stop being the one in charge. And so that's what step three is trying to get us to do, which is to relinquish control of our lives. And of course, we start out by relinquishing control of our alcoholism and retaining control of the rest. And I sometimes like to think about that is that my life is my territory. You know what I mean? It's mine. We like ownership. I like to own a home, and I got a spread, and I got that, and it's mine. And so my life and the territory that it includes is mine. I'm the exclusive owner of my territory. And I just reluctantly carved off alcoholism and let someone have that. In the beginning, when you're extremely self-centered, your territory includes the entire universe. And when you hear about things happening in some distant galaxy that you didn't approve of, you can feel a big resentment about whatever the hell is going on out in that galaxy. So if you really take your self-centeredness out, you can, your territory can be the whole universe. So just for discussion purposes, let's say that you're humble and your territory is just the United States. And when you surrender alcoholism, you gave up Texas. But nobody's getting Delaware away from you, and nobody's getting New Jersey away from you, and we're not going to get this. And so you can see, you haven't surrendered too far. Even though it feels like you gave up a lot. Texas is big. What do you want out of me? You want me to end up with no territory? Come on. What'll I be, the hole in the donut? You remember that in the step three in the 12 and 12? I'll be a non-entity. A non-entity is a completely spiritual person. Oh, I thought it was a put-down. Hole in the donut. So that's why we're doing step four, is we're trying to let go of more territory. And in order to do that, we have to find out what it is that we're holding on to with a death grip. And of course, a resentment is an example of it, or a fear, or defects, whatever they are, they're ours. And you say, well, geez, you could get rid of that resentment. All you have to do is forgive the guy. No way. No way. No, what he did, I ain't figured that, you know, that's way beyond. No. Well, you're going to have to keep the resentment. All right. I'm not going to, you know. And so you can see that when we say the whole program is let go and let God, we don't like letting go. And so picture if your ownership of your territory is two closed fists, and you just had this finger pried loose and you dropped alcoholism. And the rest of it is like this. So if you were to think about it, the main action verb, you like action, you know, it's a program of action, 12 steps, and this is an action program. The main big action is letting go. That doesn't sound very cool, does it? Well, I'm going to go out today and really let go. I mean, here's the whole program. Boop. Done. That would be the end of it. It takes years to go from here to here. We go, and then, sorry. No. I'll get rid of most of it. I'll give you part of New Jersey. How's that? Okay. You want me to let go of everything? Now, see, it sounds so silly that we would sit here saying, if you let go of everything, you'd be perfectly happy. That's where happiness lies. You can only be happy if you're close to God. All the stuff we've been hearing in the material world, they talk about if you go to school, you study hard, you work hard, you get your own company, you will get promoted, and then you'll have money, and then you'll go up here, and then you'll have this, and then you'll have that. That's all true. But there's this little asterisk down the bottom. This does not give you happiness. It's in very small print. Even when they sell you a yacht, there's a little tiny, it's almost in a foreign language. Owning this yacht will not make you happy. And it's almost like you ought to be able to turn the yacht back in and go, hey, I saw guys going around on those big yachts, and they all looked happy, and I got one, and I'm out there, and I'm thinking of committing suicide. The yacht doesn't work. So you can see that it's going to require a revolutionary change in thinking to make getting close to God our top goal. That's a revolutionary change in thinking. And so here we are coming into this inventory of what is it that we're going to have to let go of. So that's a different way of looking at the fourth step. What is it that I'm going to get rid of? What are all the things that are bothering me? You know, bother me. It's all about me. So I'm listing resentments and fears and a sexual inventory. And if you go to the 12 and 12, then you have the seven deadly sins. I use both books, but I primarily go through the outline that's in the big book, because you can kind of put it on a yellow pad and list the things and then have the what's my part and how did it affect my self-esteem and how did it affect this. So there's a mechanical way of laying out a fourth step that is very, very, very good in the big book, and I'm sure everybody in this room is very, very familiar with the mechanics of laying this out. But the 12 and 12 is interesting in that it helps us understand why we have character defects. Now, without that, we just blame ourselves for having them. I shouldn't be lustful. I shouldn't be afraid. I shouldn't be greedy. I shouldn't be like there was some way you could have prevented it. Do you follow what I'm saying? And when you read the 12 and 12, it shows you where these all come from. They come from instinctual drives that were put inside of us so that we would function as human beings, form a society, reproduce, etc. And Bill calls them the drive for sex, security, and society. So everybody is stuck with these drives, or we wouldn't stay alive, we wouldn't eat, and we wouldn't. So they're there. They're serving a very good purpose. But as he writes in the 12 and 12, they far exceed their intended purpose. And we think that a successful life is where we achieve enough so that these demands aren't bothering us anymore. Peace of mind would be satisfying all demands. Does that make sense? Everybody know what I'm talking about? I have financial insecurity. Well, if you got enough money, you could meet this demand, and then you would have peace of mind in the financial security area. So in the material world, it looks like the only way out of the dilemma of having these instinctual drives constantly put demands on us is to get more and to get people to behave differently. It's clear that the problem is this guy keeps doing that, and it's in the way of me getting there, which is where I need to get in order to be happy and have these things quiet. The problem is he's trying to do the same thing and you're in his way. So we're having terrible conflict out there. And lo and behold comes the surprise of all surprises. In the spiritual world, we find a way of reducing these demands so that the fear of economic insecurity can be removed without any money showing up. First time my sponsor told me that, I went, yeah, sure. I think I said, well, that may be technically correct. But I think I'd rather have the money part than freedom from economic insecurity. Do you follow what I'm saying? I just don't think that works. I just don't think that works. And he said, well, really? Let's think back to the years when you were drinking and you had terrible, you were worried about money all day. You didn't have the rent money. It's due in 2 days. So you went in the bar to think it over. And if I recall, at about an hour after you got to the bar, you took the remaining rent money and said, everybody in the bar, on me. Where did the financial insecurity go? It wasn't there then, was it? Hey, eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow you may die. We're living the day at a time. Why worry about tomorrow? Hey, everybody have a round, blah, blah. So a power took away financial insecurity. That was the wrong power, and it was the wrong way of doing it, but at least you know what it felt like to have financial insecurity go away, have fear go away. Remember that? You're just terrified, all your anxiety, you can hardly talk to anybody, and you mousey your way in, and then one, two, three, hey, how you doing? Now you can't shut them up. Blah, 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 blah. So we all know what it's like to have these problems removed, which is what alcohol did. God is a much bigger power than alcohol, but he doesn't act as fast as alcohol because he's trying to teach us some values and that are hard to get so that they have value. The spiritual journey has to be hard or it's valueless. You know, what if it was possible to lose weight and have a perfect body and be beautiful or handsome by going in this place and they put a machine, you go, done, and you're out of there. Everybody would have a perfect body, be beautiful and happy, and not happy, but would have this. And you'd look around, everybody has it. It didn't require any effort. It would have no value. You know what I mean? In other words, the thing that gives it value is the hard work that you put into it. I remember way back, they were really ahead of their time. Some college was advertising, come to our college, 90% of our students end up in the top 10%. That's a nice ad, isn't it? Can't be done, but it really sounds wonderful. I'm going to be in the top 10%. 90% of us are going to be in the top 10%. It wouldn't be much value to be in that crowd, would it? Yep, graduating the top 10%. So anyway, we are inventorying. I guess the important thing is the motive for doing this. It's not because your sponsor's on your back. It's because this is how we're going to get close to our higher power and be happy and have peace of mind. That's why we're doing this fourth step. And as Bob said yesterday, that's why we're doing all the rest of the steps, is to accomplish 1, 2, and 3. So I think it's in the big book, I can't remember, and it said the fourth step is the first evidence of our willingness to go forward. Am I really willing to try and turn my life over? Well, a fourth and fifth step takes a lot of willingness, and it's a sure indication that you are interested in pursuing this spiritual path. It's not some ordeal that you just want to get through so you can tell everybody, I finally did my fourth and fifth step. See, that would just be selling it short. You have to understand that what you did was a major step in moving closer to this creator that we want to have contact with. And so that's why this is all laid out, is to allow that to happen. I like to use, mechanically, to use the outline in the big book, and then I just suggest to the people that I sponsor that after they finish, just separately write down the 7 deadly sins and see if, when you look at pride and examples of where pride got you in trouble, does something else come up that you didn't think of when you did it out of the big book? Do you see what I'm saying? You might get to envy, and then you just said, oh my God, I forgot all about Mary Lou. And I used to envy her thing, and I had a big resentment that she dressed better than I. And suddenly we have a mechanical way of adding to what we already had on our list in the big book. And we also learn out of taking a look at the 7 deadly sins. I love the fact that he didn't call them 7 deadly character defects. Just tease people a little bit. We learn, as Bill said, that pride heads the list. And if you're not familiar, pride is the main character defect. Pride is used to justify all the others. And so when we study it, and we'll see when we get to step seven, that humility is the absence of pride. And so pride is a very important thing to understand. Pride is why you don't want to give up New Jersey. Because then I'll have less territory than the guy next to me. And it's important for me to feel good about myself that I have more territory than other people. Because if I have less territory than other people, I'm not going to feel as good as them. And so pride is a very essence of self-centeredness. Pride doesn't even like to hear the word God. Let's not talk about God. Enough about God. Let's talk about me. Now we're on a topic that I enjoy talking about. Let me tell you about me. And boy, when you get the conversation around to me, you get my attention. And I'll go on and on. Yeah, let me tell you something else. Blah, 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 blah. Boy, I'll just go on and on. Well, enough about you. Let's talk about God. All right, yeah, all right. You see that? You feel resistance to talking about God? Where do you think that's coming from? You don't like the word? Your pride doesn't like to acknowledge that he even exists. Chuck Chamberlain had that wonderful diagram in his book about the universe, and he had this great big circle, and then the dot was the person, and the person was outside the circle. The person was somewhere other than in the universe. So how could someone exist outside the universe? If God is everything, how could I exist in addition to God? That's what pride does. Pride says, yes, there's everything, and there's also, in addition to everything, you. Are you starting to get it? Yeah. In addition to everything. In other words, I'm not part of everything. In a secret way, I am everything. So how could you exist in addition to God if God is everything? It's very simple. You make up a story that you exist in addition to everything and believe it. And it's called an old idea. And when we smash it, you don't exist in addition to everything. So when we say, well, I'm going to get up tonight and tell you my story, that's the right word. Well, I'm not going to tell you facts. I'm going to tell you my story about things. And my story is I exist in addition to God. There's him, and then there's me. I'm over here. He's over there. Well, that's impossible. No, it isn't. I do it all the time. So when we generate ideas that aren't true and we believe them, the next thing that happens, we feel the truth that we said. And so if I tell myself, that person that just walked in back there is dangerous, and then I believe it, now I'm afraid of him. Haven't even met him. I just told myself these ideas, which I can do since I own the world. What I pronounce is a pronouncement, and then I emotionally react to it, and so I'm filled with fears, anxieties, and all these things. And as Bob said, when I work with people who have problems, my job is to show them they don't have a problem, that they really saw this guy incorrectly. I'll tell you all about him. He's a wonderful guy. And then you go, oh, okay, well, then I'm not afraid anymore. And the problem got removed by seeing the truth that you couldn't see when you made up the truth and believed it. So you see where we're going in this whole thing? One of the main things that's happened in a fourth step is Bill talks about rationalization as one of our major character defects, right or wrong. Right. So if you rationalize all the time, how do you know all this crap you wrote down on the paper here has any value at all? How could you possibly believe something if you rationalize all the time? That's why we need a fifth step, which Bob is going to talk about in a minute. We need somebody else to show us our part. We can't see it. We need somebody else to say, what was the incident between you and Hiram? Yeah, no, 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 no. Yeah, but don't you think that... No. Well, I think Hiram had a right to tell you that. I don't want to hear about some other way of looking at this incident. But that's what happens. And when we get through, that fourth step doesn't look like it did when there was just you looking at it. And, well, I've talked long enough.
God, I could just listen to that forever. It's hard. Sandy and I enjoy doing this together, and one of the reasons he said he came is because I was here. It's hard to discover that the reason they asked me is so he came. It's just those little flashes that you get, you know.
One way of looking.
My mother always said, Bob, you're not very bright. Dress well. And I have. But every once in a while, I get an insight. And it is. No, you have a. The gift of having done the work. I mean, you know, so people sometimes come up and say, oh, you're wonderful. You know so much. It's just great. You know, we've been going to meetings for 3 to 5 days a week for 40-some years. We've had sponsors over that time. We sponsor considerable people. We go to a lot of AA events. We have a practice of prayer and meditation. I mean, there's a lot of cumulative, you know, participation in the program. Sandy has talked a couple of times about the simplicity, that sometimes we overcomplicate. How did the first members and we've been lucky enough, you go someplace and you celebrate the founding of AA in Austin and you meet the guy who founded AA in Austin. He's not special. He just put a coffee pot on and put an ad in the newspaper, went down to the jail, talked to some people, and held a meeting alone for a year. Bob White held a meeting alone for almost a year in Whitney, Texas. And then you pray that the first guy you get is going to be a real winner. Usually not. You know, and then one by one by one, you know, they build into this critical mass. It's astounding. I was at a big roundup last weekend, and they had someone who was a historian talk about how things used to be and how it was much better and the correct way to do the program. If we knew what the heck we were doing today, and we should go back, you can take the steps, you know, in a couple of days, and you don't. And I should be careful because I'm talking on tape, but I think there's almost some of this is a rewriting of history. There is some correctness in it, and there's some mischief in it. Can you take the step in a few days? I think you can. Bill Wilson, by his own description, took most of the steps in his hospital room while he was at Towns Hospital, which is an astounding, you know, large paragraph in the book that he talked, you know, about doing all that. I think when we're surrendered and in a spiritual state, when someone says you admit to you're powerless, you just admit you're powerless. Your life's unmanageable. Yep, my life's unmanageable. Come to believe the power greater than yourself. Yep. You know, I want you to turn your will and your life over to that power. Okay. I mean, and here I want you to do an inventory of the people you'd harmed and, you know, the things that are causing you trouble in your life. Okay. And then I want you to go those, you know, I want you to tell your story to another person. There's nothing in the way. There's just no resistance. They're, you know, and when you're in that state, they are almost as, I think they're as simple as they're written. And if there's anything, if you dealt with them that simply and it turned out that there was something that you, quote, missed. Well, if you stay, you could just correct it or add it or do that. But in that space, it's almost that simple. As time goes on, it gets more complicated because we want it more complicated. The mind complicates it. The story, our identity, our separateness complicates it. That is what, in this space, you know, you can almost feel the vibe in this room. We don't want complicated right now. Simple is just fine. It's just, it's okay. There's a peacefulness in the simplicity. I like it. And I think it's okay. Now, we've been to other events where you just can't get the pencil out fast enough because the guy's got a new form or the gal's got a new form, and there's a technically better, more efficient way to do what we're doing. And that's the mind. Your heart will hear and contain everything that your heart needs to hear and contain in this process. Trust yourself. The last couple of years, I made a lot of money. I went broke in 91, 90. Went bankrupt, close. Made it all back, and I've dug a big hole in the last few years to see if I can throw it all away again. If you could get me a yacht, I'd like to have the experience of discovering that it doesn't work. I've had to discover that lesson at a much lower level, and I think if I could discover it at a higher level, it would stick. It would work. Because it doesn't stick, and and those are two of the major depressions I've suffered in my sobriety. And for people who know me, I've been whining for almost, I've been in a depression for almost, I said one time, for almost 2 years, a year and a half, my wife said, you've been in a depression for 2.5 years. And, I'm negotiating with banks, we had to call people in to help restructure the company, and I mean, tough stuff, not much fun. And if you made the mistake of asking me how I was, I would tell you. And the interesting part of it, well, first of all, being an old timer, one of my responsibilities is I want to be a member. I don't want to be just a teacher or, you know, so when you ask me how I am, I think I've got some responsibility to say I'm a 4 today or I'm an 8, you know, I mean, you know, just so you know, I'm playing too. I'm, you know, it's raining and the wind's blowing, and I've got a golf club in my hand, and I'm out there on the same course you are, and it isn't pretty. You hit a 9-iron a hell of a lot different when the wind's going 30 miles an hour than you do when it's, you know, sunny and nice. But the pain I went through, real pain, real depression, was an illusion. I mean, when I finally woke up out of it, now, it isn't like you wouldn't notice going through the significant issues that you would notice. But the pain and the story in it, was just a joke. It was not that funny. It wasn't a funny. I mean, it was only funny because it wasn't happening to you. I mean, it was. Same wife, same business, same house, same car, same AA group, same children, same clothes, same body. I mean, and I thought I was dying. Numbers on a page. I thought I was dying. I mean, when you talk about identity, being different, being separate, not being part of, not being connected spiritually in that space, just unbelievable. So I went to, when this thing started, I know there was a reason I brought that up other than to talk about myself. My partner is sober a little bit longer than Sandy, and he has this woman that he's been going to, who I've known over a long period of time, and she's in the special school of psychology, and I just out of desperateness went to this woman. and I go in and I sit down and tell her my tale of woe, which I'm very good at, very articulate. I think I laid it out well. And I'm in tears. And she looked at me and she said, "Do you know what the problem is?" I said, "Just explained it to her." Yeah, I said, "Yeah, I think I do." And she said, "Oh, honey, you've forgotten who you are." I didn't talk for 15 minutes. We just sat in that space. That was, I forgot who I was. Child of God. I mean, it's all there was. I mean, I told her later, I said, "You're a fraud. I have, I said, just like my sponsor, I get in the car and I drive over. I said, "By the time I get in your building and start to push the elevator to go up to the building, my problems are gone. It just, and then I'm paying you $130 when I forgot why I drove all the way over across town to come up to your place. We have forgotten who we are. It takes you 30 years to build an identity, and you spend the rest of your life trying to get rid of it. And one of the reasons we look at children like looking at small children, looking at God, is they haven't established. They're still kind of ethereal. Their materialism is not as well defined, and it is like looking at God. So someone said, you know, the process. You spend the first section of your life becoming someone. You spend the next section of your life becoming no one. And you spend the last section of your life becoming everyone. And it is as you drop the separateness. And I just jotted a couple ideas that Sandy talked about. You talked about how alcohol, other people have said, you know, alcohol gives you the promises. You know, that you lose your fear. You lose your fear of economic insecurity. You intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you and all that sort of thing. And the reason it does and the reason that it's still profound for us, how does it do it? It lowers our consciousness. And the angst goes away. And there's a freedom in that space. Doesn't last, doesn't work long, has consequences. And over a long period of time, if you're alcoholic, it'll kill you. How does our program give us the promises? By increasing our consciousness. It does exactly the same thing, but in a sustainable, stable, correct way. It raises our consciousness and gives us the same feeling, the same sense of peace and okayness that we had when we drank. We get to find in sobriety what we're looking for in a bottle, which is, I think, the ultimate. It really works. It really does. And now we're looking at step five. And again, I say that for a lot of us, step five, I got one other thing I'm gonna forget to say, I think, if I don't say it. Yesterday I talked about what's the difference of the people coming in today, and I talked about structure and family and age, and drugs are a little bit different, and so forth. One of the main differences is because we have established alcoholism and drug dependency as a disease, it's treated like a disease. It's treated in hospitals. It's treated in treatment centers. It's diagnosed by doctors. It's, you know, it's being handled in a slightly different way than when all we had was a national council or a local intergroup or just the AA group that we did. So we're getting to people earlier in their processes, good news and bad news. But the problem is that a lot of people have been screwed up since their teens. So while we're getting them early in the process, they're plenty screwed up. I mean, the drugs collapsed the, you know, there were a lot of people who drank for, you know, 20, 30 years and then crossed over a line and couldn't get back. you're not usually out there on cocaine 20 or 30 years, you know, or meth or whatever the heck's, you know, floating around today along with the alcohol that you're using. It really collapses that thing. But because we're getting to people, and they're coming in because they're because of the consequences of the drinking, the, you know, legal, all that sort of stuff. But many of them feel like they're giving something up. So one of the profound differences that I perceive in the older days, the people that came in that were the chronic, the you know, the they were really well enmeshed in the disease process of alcoholism, they were like they were given life back. They were like they were given a way out. They were like being let out of jail. So many of these younger people, I feel like I'm convincing them. I'm not, and I'm old enough that I usually catch myself in that conversation, but they're resistant because they're not sure they're ready. They're not sure they want to. There's still this allure. And for many of the people that came in the 40s, 50s, 60s, the allure was gone, well gone. Okay, and that is one of the most significant factors, I think, because ultimately what we're looking at, this is a change of heart. This is not a change of head. This is not an information process. The process we're talking about is a hell of a lot more like a sex change operation than a self-improvement program. I mean, it is. It literally changes every single thing you were about. It is a transformation. It is not linear. Okay. So we go through the first three steps. We do our inventory, and again, the ability for us often to do the inventory. Isn't super high. That's why you need, certainly this and steps 8 and 9 are the where you probably need as much sponsor guidance in that process as you do anything else. So you do the very best job you can. Does not have to be perfect. The first one I did in the form of a general confession. Did not use the form of the big book. I read the big book. I read the 12 and 12. I read a guide. Didn't do it that way, and I got what I got. Was it perfect? Heavens no. But I did another one when I was 3 years sober, and I did another one when I'm 7, and I've probably done 15 or 20, you know, since I've been sober, because I stayed and, you know, went and did that. But think of what we're about to do. You're about to sit someone down and talk about the things in your life that you've never talked to anybody else about, the secrets, the things that separate you. Sandy talks about his favorite meetings are speaker meetings, and they haven't historically been my favorite meetings. And I think he says the reason he likes the speaker meetings is because you get to hear the person's story, and when you hear the person's story, they've communicated themselves to you. You know them in a much different way than you knew them before. Prior to that, you're just getting their thoughts about something, and when you listen to someone give their story, first of all, it's a major rite of passage for them, and it is a connector for us if we're open to it. But for those of us who have lived our lives, as many of us sometimes do today, we've been driving around in a tank with a slit through the tank, with a 30 caliber machine gun out the front of the tank, okay? No one gets in the tank. We're going around taking out people that are bothersome to us. Okay. We have decorated the tank. So we all have, we are comparing each other's tanks. We have forgotten we're the drivers, we're the tanks. And there's new models and old models and fancier sorts of things. And we are about, for the first time in our lives, about to open the door and get out of the tank. We've been in that tank most of our lives. This is not a small deal. This is about as vulnerable as we have ever been in our lives, and there would be only one reason to do it. To be able to do it is the fact that we have surrendered to a significant degree, and we have come to believe that this process, that we've surrendered to a process, and to a God, and we are about to do something that under normal circumstances we would never do. And we sit down and we tell another person our life story in whatever form that it has taken that we have done our four step in. We go through all the resentments and all the fears and all the sex conduct. And I think it's important that Sandy said that later he has his guys go through the seven deadly sins. I find if I had a complaint about how this process, there has never been so much teaching about the steps as there is in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And there's in every spiritual movement, there's a movement towards orthodoxy. And there's a movement towards orthodoxy that's strong in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a feeling like if, you know, the better you are, the more you can recite the first 164 pages of the book. That's the menu. You can starve to death eating the menu. Okay? I know plenty of people who have memorized the first 164 pages, and many of them I would not want to go on a fishing trip with. I mean, it is not, okay. And there are people who are more orthodox than I am, who are more Green Beret-ish than I am, who I have a great admiration for because they're doing great work. So you don't have to be, you know, there isn't just one way you have to be for me, but I'm talking about the movement towards orthodoxy. It gets violent. You start to take spiritual principles and use them as weapons. You start to find who the good guys and the bad guys are, who's right and who's wrong. That is not of God. You never heard that conversation in the 60s. I mean, if someone, or the 70s or the 80s. The question was, are they still in AA? Are they still sober? If they were sober, you were pleased for them. Now, it's what group do they go to? Who's their sponsor? You know, it's just little code words that we can check out if they're in the right chain, if they're hooked up to the good guys or the bad guys. You know, but this process of opening ourselves up and, you know, admitting to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, which again are the three areas of our lives in which we get well. We admit to God, which is an important spiritual process. We have been out of communication, out of touch. It's not a small deal. You know, some guys, it's kind of gimmicky, but I kind of like it, where you send the person around the block, you know, and just say, I want you to formally go over what you've written in your four step, but I want you to formally admit to God what you've got on this piece of paper. And then they sometimes ask the person to go into the bathroom and look in the mirror. You know, now the person's admitted to themselves when they did the step, but just, I want you to look in the mirror, and I want you to admit to yourself what you've got down on this paper. And then we'll come in and we'll ask God to come in the room and we'll have a conversation about, you know, we'll do your fifth step. And it's a really big deal. When you look at the promises both in the 12 and 12 and in the big book, when it talks about the sense of isolation, you know, has ended. You really feel part of. You have torn down the wall that you have built up. I came in here with a wall built up around me, and the wall says, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me. Hell, I hate me. Who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient person I am? I'm walking around comparing my inside with your outsides. And then I start to tear the wall down. And the internal conversation is, come and get me. I don't care who you are or where you come from, but just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. I can't stand me or it 5 more minutes. And for the first time in my life, I share the whole deck of cards with someone. And you make a discovery. And the discovery is you're not unique. Your personality may be unique, not your illness, not your behavior, not your feelings, not your experience. And you start to have a sense of hope at a level that you've never had it before that would work for the person you're talking to and would work for Harry and the group, could work for you. If you don't lose a significant enough amount of that uniqueness, you will not stay. You will look for the differences rather than the similarities. and you will difference your way out of the room or out of the work, which in most cases is kind of the same thing. It is the first, it isn't the first, but I think most of us consider it one of the great rites of passage in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we are, and rightfully so. I think in our area, we overdo, because I think we're a little bit more intellectual, we have more step discussion groups, not as many speaker meetings, and we have a lot of treatment. And I think because of the amount of treatment we've had, I think we overemphasize 4 and 5 and underemphasize 8 and 9. I don't know how is that true? I don't know. But I think that a lot of us, when we're in trouble, where we want to go back to is 4 and 5. Why? Because we think we're going to get information. We're not missing any information. The problems we have are not new. They aren't weeks old, they aren't days old, they aren't months old. They're years old, okay? If we've done our inventory properly, we start to see patterns. I mean, this coming in with 85 pages is just, nuts. I mean, the psychology, what's the religion of today? Psychology. Okay, there's an endless need for information about ourselves and insight. It is not, and I think we overdo that. We go back on the playground. We go back into kindergarten. We go back with the conversations. I think anything that bothers you should end up on the page, but I think it is really overdone. I mean, I've had people come up to me that want to make amends, and they just said, I want me to make an amends. I've always thought you were an asshole. And I just wanted to share that with you.
Thanks for sharing, Bob.
Yeah. And, I mean, I have. I've had, I probably should look at why I've had 3 of those. But there may be a pattern. But when we are through with this process, there's a sense of belonging that has not been there before. There's a sense that we're a member in a way that we have not felt it before. And we've not felt it because this is the first time we've gotten out of our tank and torn down the wall, the separator. And when we've torn down that wall, anybody watch the movie Cocoon? Okay, and they go to the pool and they zip the suits off. And inside the suits, the human skin suits, the ego, we sound like you can get rid of the ego. It's a spacesuit. You can't take the trip without it. We constructed it. It's an illusion, but you can't take the trip without it. It's a mechanism that's necessary, but you have to end up at some point in time making it a junior partner. And you have to be able to observe it and see it and minimize its negative effect, but you need it for the trip. But when they unzip the suits, they're all the same inside. And we have those moments, okay, where we know that. And we have taken one of the great spiritual walks through the first, people talk about what's the decision in step 3, that some people say the decision you make in step 3, when, they used to have you go up and you couldn't go to the meeting at the Williams house until you had, had made your decision, which, in the old days they talked about like that was really much more of an action than I think most of us think of a decision today. Oh, make a decision. No, they made a decision on their knees, and it seemed like it was a bigger deal when they describe it and talk about it in that thing. And so some people would say the decision is you're going to do the rest of the work. Mm-hmm. You're going to do 4 through 9. Okay, that's the decision. And some people say, no, the decision is I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of God, which eventually ends up simply being like you're recognizing, like you've decided that you're going to operate under the law of gravity. That you discover that you're really an ant on a log going down a river. Looks like you're steering it. but it's an illusion. Our lives are and have always been in the care of this higher power. So it is to take the broken person who came in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous with the dead eyes, because they had to. They had no place else to go, and they didn't really want to be where they were sent or had to go when they walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't believe almost anything they heard when they walked in the front door. But there was something about the people. There was something about the process. There was something about the lack of judgment. There was something about the understanding. There's something about the welcoming. There was something about it that they felt like they were home. They couldn't explain it, but they just, it felt different than any place they have ever been. It was different than any helping place they have ever been. There was no tests. There was no written exam. There was no requirements. There were no belief requirements. They said, you'll diagnose yourself. If you come in here and you want what we have, we'll help you go through the process that we've gone through. And that's what they did. And as a result of going through that process, we have been forced into one of the great privileges of life to start to have an experience of the God of our understanding. The difference between religion and spirituality is that word experience. All we're interested in is your having an experience of the God of your understanding. Once you start to have that conversation, even if you don't know you're having that conversation, we used to get together, we'd get together after some of the open houses, and we'd talk till the sun came up. We'd talk all night long. The women would sometimes go home in the car, or they'd go to bed in one of the bedrooms of the house, and the guys would stay in the living room, and we'd talk till 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. What we were doing, we're just talking AA. And we weren't generally talking about God. But if I look back on that conversation, it was a God conversation. I mean, it was about what we were doing in the program and telling stories, and it was just like a group of hunters getting together telling hunting stories. It was a group of AAs getting together talking about guys that came in and came out and why didn't they stay and what we're doing. And, you know, it was just, and we were so caught up in it, we could just do it forever. It was just the biggest, best conversation I've ever had in my life. There wasn't any other place in my life that was working. There wasn't anything positive externally going on in my life. AA, early on, was the only place in my life that worked. And it was a treasure. So when we get into step four, we know that what comes after four, five, you know, which is why a lot of people have trouble with that process, because they really don't want to take their clothes off and have that discussion with another person. But four and five is where you cross the Rubicon. Four and five is where, for the first time in your life, you get out of the tank, you tear down the wall, and you get out of yourself to that degree, and you become part of. And it is, I don't think life is ever the same after that process if you've done it to the best of your ability.
Let me take a break or keep going?
If you want to say something, go ahead.
Why don't we take a break?